Welcome to this, our eighth session, where we investigate teaching, learning, and the knowledge economy. Hi, I'm Tara Brabazon. Thank you for joining me again. So we commence this session with an image of exclusion. At the end of Once Were Warriors, a violent and frustrated Jake was verbally castrated and void of mana by his soon-to-be ex-wife, Beth. This image conveys a loss of control and a reduction in a self. Education and training, from the earliest socialisation in the home through to a PhD level at university, cannot overcome these multi-layered, these complex societal inequalities. These impressions include those issues, those difficulties faced by Indigenous people through the process of colonisation, but also differently abled students who confront concerns with mobility and access, or students who must balance the truths of a first language with different truths and languages they may encounter at school or university. This session is really the core of the course. It's at the centre of the course too. We confront the phrase knowledge economy and explore its relationship or disconnection from teaching, learning and education. So I am asking big questions of you today, wherever you're listening to this, whether it be at home, whether you've taken it to the gym to listen to, whether it's in the car. While you're listening to me today, I really want you to ask some questions of yourselves. Why you were enrolled in a degree at Murdoch University? Why you were enrolled in this course? What you wish to get from an education? We also explore if and then how the future of schools and universities are locked into the future of creative industries. There is no doubt that learning is a big business, big money maker. So whether we're discussing the University of the Third Age or personal development courses, self-help bestsellers or hard-edged vocational qualifications, the definitions of learning, let alone education, are certainly expanding. Concurrent with this growth, governments are reducing the centralised funding and promoting alternative revenue streams for education. So the diversity of student interests, or to use the language of the time, clients' learning goals, is transforming higher education into more than the provision of undergraduate or postgraduate degrees. The expansion, the correct expansion of the student body beyond the 18 to 25 age group, and a desire to service industry, which sounds a bit dodgy but probably means something, has reordered the form and the purpose of formal education. So the potential number of students that a university could be engaging with at any time has expanded extraordinarily. All these movements and ideas are embodied and embedded in one phrase, and that is lifelong learning. Lifelong learning. Lifelong learning is a catchphrase for a change in the purpose and the agenda of universities and is used in tandem with the phrase knowledge economy. Courses are developed from a wide range of educational providers so that citizens can function in, or at least survive, the agitations of being in the post-war world. Both neoliberal and third way models of capitalism require the labelling and the development of an aspirational class, a group who desire to move above their current context. So such an ambiguous economic and social goal always involves more than the vocational education and training sector or university, with the aim being to slot education into a lifestyle. So with the casualisation of the post-Fordist workplace, it's no surprise that policymakers and employers are placing the economic and personal responsibility for retraining workers on the individual workers themselves. So instead of funding a training scheme in the workplace, there has been a devolving of skill acquisition and personal development to the individual worker. So my question is why employers are not responsible for training their own workforce. Universities have always, throughout their history, had a much wider function than training workers. So why would anyone, spend 3 years gaining a degree to obtain a part-time, casualised or contract job? So obviously education has changed. It's always been marinated in the political directives of the day. The Industrial Revolution introduced a range of new technical complexities to the workforce. Fordism necessitated that a worker complete a task with precision and speed, requiring a high tolerance of stress and indeed boredom. Now, more and more and more skills are being assumed by employers at the very time that workplaces are offloading their training expectations to universities and the post-compulsory education sector. Therefore, lifelong learning is a political mask to empower the already empowered and create a low-level skill base for low-paid workers with the promise of competency-based training. Not surprising, therefore, lifelong learning has a rich new life facilitating and facilitated by the creative industry's strategies and frameworks. The legacy of the 1980s and the 90s is that all organisations must now behave like businesses. In such an environment, there are problems in establishing a sense of community, a sense of social cohesion, let alone social justice. So when we stress the product, not the process of education, then we actually contradict the point of lifelong learning. Compliance and complicity replaces critique. But we also live in a time of terrorism and a fear of difference. A task of education, and indeed governmental education policy, must be to think about and through difference. Therefore, the rest of this session explores the other purposes of education. Education is more complex and more important than any of these debates around the knowledge economy may suggest. When we learn, we do so for many reasons. So think about the complexity of your own life and how often you learn something, how often you teach somebody something. Mostly through our lives, we're taught about what is normal and how to judge and exclude those who are different. Think about teachers like me. We grade, we assess, we judge, we label. But that is the accepted nature of education. To label a person not only confirms their difference from you, but your power over them. And if you're able to make that label stick beyond a single moment, it demonstrates the power of the discourse that you're using. So the educational discourse is both highly normative and influential. The language of exclusion includes handicapped, slow learner, ADD, Down syndrome, and of course dyslexic. The 1970s saw the integration of the handicapped with the non-handicapped, with a resultant change in language. We don't use handicapped anymore. So new languages replace the old, like deinstitutionalisation, mainstreaming and integrating. So while the terminology has changed, many of the assumptions do remain. Social knowledge is not neutral. The meritocratic illusion, so that's that word meritocracy, the meritocratic illusion which suggests that anyone can be successful, means that educational outcomes are riddled with class, ethnic and gender biases. We see this sort of stuff in films like Dangerous Minds or Stand and Deliver, the notion that if you work hard you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you can be successful. But there is some optimism. Language can be used by educators to combat social inequalities. We can support the differences of students. So really there are three reasons why you are here and attaining an education. The vocational, the democratic, and the academic. I'll say those again. The three reasons to get an education are basically vocational, democratic, and academic. The vocational curriculum is an education that prepares you for work. Schools teach regularity, discipline, and obedience. This curriculum, therefore, serves class-based economic and political interests. This ideology, of course, is increasing in its current influence. The democratic curriculum activates education as a socially beneficial force. Within this framework, education is the right of all people, offering preparation for equality, preparation for citizens to participate in social life. The universal access to education, therefore, is absolutely crucial to this democratic curriculum. The academic curriculum is education for its own sake. This view has its origins in classical Greece, but also in the English Oxbridge system. This curriculum organises knowledge into subject areas and into hierarchical relationships. So that means English literature and physics become more important than typing and home economics. So when we succeed in an academic curriculum, we gain high status employment. So while a lot of us in media studies and many educational theorists stress the emancipatory origin of education theory, the disciplinary mode is the one that's granted the most attention. This is particularly ironic in an environment where education is no longer an automatic passport to a job. Currently, education is being blamed for too many global economic problems. It is far easier to blame schools, to blame universities, to blame teachers, than to confront the more complex issues of structural unemployment and underemployment. When in doubt, blame the teachers. So while most teachers prepare students for participation in some sort of democratic citizenry, the entire educational system really revolves around seven words. Will this course get me a job? Men and women have a right to learn. They do. But they also have a responsibility to understand and transform their own lives, their own experiences. So there's a new and complex relationship being formed between education and training, teaching and learning, and knowledge production and knowledge dissemination. The creative industries have blurred these sort of terms, like teaching and training. It means that education is very difficult to justify for any reason beyond the economic. But you know what? Thinking is important. We need to think more. And it is time that we bring back the difficult reading, the difficult learning, the difficult thinking. We bring the knowledge back to the knowledge economy.